Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 31st of July, 1995. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Gail Ifrig, and she will be doing a session entitled Literary Feasts, Community. So let's listen in on Gail.
I'm Gail McGrew Ifrig, and it's my great pleasure to come and have a group of people with whom to talk about some texts that have to do with feasting. I have an assemblage of some selections that I will hope that as we spend some time together, people will read those pieces, and then things about them will come up at various times throughout our times together. I don't mean to make assignments that are sort of one for one. You know, this thing is to read for this night, and this for another. When thinking about what this session could be about and how to do literature and feasting, I am more used, I suppose, that we would try to figure out more about the foretaste of the feast to come by looking at liturgy and scripture and exegesis and doctrine. To do a wonderful lecture on the Greek texts about the Eucharist, like Edgar Krenz could do, but I'm not suited to do that kind of lecture. Instead, it seemed to me that one of the ways we could do this is to see in texts, in literary texts, what they illuminate about feasting and learn from them a kind of greater consciousness about what we mean by calling this event, you can call a future in eternity an event, why we call experience of the presence of God, what we mean when we call that a feast, and that would be if for our lives a feast to come. So I started my thinking about this by identifying a sequence or a series of what I've called human needs, those qualities, hungers, those hungers that identify human life. And I'm sure that when you look at my list of what I have called human needs, it may be more self-revelatory than it ought to be. There's a copy of that posted up on the bulletin board, and a copy of it is around here. So I have sort of structured these sessions around that sequence or that list of what I call human needs. And then a group of texts that I think illustrate the ways in which those needs are met in the experience of feasting. And then I would think that it's possible to move back and forth from the idea of literal feasts, what we actually do in feasts, the feasts that are represented in literary texts of all kinds, and then what we might extrapolate from that or what we might mean about that when we are thinking in religious terms specifically. Those needs I have identified as these: community, intimacy, abundance, sacrifice, ceremony, sensuousness, reward, timelessness, service, and closure. That as human beings, we need each of those things, and in a number of different ways, feasting fills us at the point of each of those needs. So the one I have started with for this evening is a pretty obvious one, I suppose, and that is community, a very highly overworked word, for one thing. And what I want to do this evening is really to, in some ways, to bracket Babette's Feast, though I know that both Babette's Feast and The Wind and the Willows are books that I would expect to keep coming up throughout each of these sessions, that I think that things about those two texts would be so important and so meaningful that they will be hard to keep out of our discussions. I have given the bookstore, when it asks what text would be sort of recommended, I think is the appropriate word for this kind of session, not required, but strongly recommended, that both The Wind in the Willows, which is a kind of a children's book, or is sometimes identified as a children's book, is there in this edition, should you wish to get that. And also, Babette's Feast, though it is identified technically on the shelves as a book by its collections title, which is Anecdotes of Destiny by Isaac Dinesen, Babette's Feast is in this collection. Tonight, then, I want to do a couple of things. One is first to say just a couple of things, which I'm sure you already know about community, just little things. And then to read some from Wind in the Willows and ask you, as I'm reading it, to hear what it says about feasting, this passage from the children's book or from the book. Community certainly means, we mean multiple people. You can't have a community of one. Community is obviously a group. Community is people who have some common history, probably, though it may take them some effort to discover that history, but they have presumably some common goals, some intentions about their lives. And when we talk about community, we most often mean that group is operating in some way simultaneously and probably in the same place. There could be more metaphorical ideas of community, but community most frequently probably means that something is happening with people simultaneously. There's a kind of mutuality of experience. And that's important for the idea of feasting. Our need for community is met in the actual experience of feast. So first I want to read this passage from Wind in the Willows. It takes about 12 minutes. And as I read it, I don't know, you're not maybe making notes, or maybe you're good at mental notes. But after I finish, we'll try to pull out some of the things that you have heard that identify elements of feasting. What is feasting for? What does it do? What are parts of feasting that help us to define it or identify it? What does it mean to feast? How many of you have read The Wind in the Willows? Enough times that you've memorized parts at some point. There are Wind in the Willows fanatics, and then there are people who can't stand it. So I will have to beg us all to be indulgent and just to kind of take a moderate middle ground here and see what we can do with it. The situation, this is one of those animal books. It was written in about 1906, 1907 by an Englishman named Kenneth Graham, who had a rather unhappy life as a bank manager, but poured out his soul in this children's book. The central character is Mole, and on the first page of the book, Mole, who is dutifully at home doing his spring cleaning, feels the pull of the natural world. And he leaves his house and his house cleaning undone and goes off on this unheard of adventure for him to the river. And there, with all the river's beauty and excitement, and he meets a wonderful friend, Rat, Water Rat, the great friend who tells him about boats, and spends the summer with Rat on the river, meeting all kinds of new animals and having a wonderful time. But the summer finally ends, and as winter comes on, then there are some sort of fallish adventures. But in the deep winter, Mole suddenly feels almost the reverse of the pull that pulled him away from home. And he feels the need to go home, to find his home. And he excitedly comes there after he sets out on this journey to go home, bringing Rat with him. Very excited to show Rat his home. But when they get there, he finds it's cold and deserted, and all his cleaning is undone, left there from last summer. And it's a very discouraging, terrible moment for him as he comes wanting to show off what he had in his mind as his home. And the chapter is called Dulce Domum, Sweet Home. Wanting to show that to his new and dear friend. And his home is cold and dark and bare. Rat, he moaned, how about your supper, you poor, cold, hungry, weary animal? I've nothing to give you, nothing, not a crumb. What a fellow you are for giving in, said the rat reproachfully. Why, only just now I saw a sardine opener on the kitchen dresser quite distinctly, and everybody knows that means there are sardines about somewhere in the neighborhood. Rouse yourself, pull yourself together, and come with me and forage. They went and foraged accordingly, hunting through every cupboard and turning out every drawer. The result was not so very depressing after all, though of course it might have been better. A tin of sardines, a box of captain's biscuits nearly full, and a German sausage encased in silver paper. There's a banquet for you, observed the rat as he arranged the table. I know some animals who would give their ears to be sitting down to a supper with us tonight. No bread, moaned the mole dolorously. No butter, no pâté de foie gras, no champagne, continued the rat, grinning. And that reminds me, what's that little door at the end of the passage? Your cellar, of course. Every luxury in this house. Just you wait a minute. He made for the cellar door. Remember, this is not his house, but his friend's house. He made for the cellar door and presently reappeared somewhat dusty with a bottle of beer in each paw and another under each arm. Self-indulgent beggar you seem to be, Mole, he observed. Deny yourself nothing. This is really the jolliest little place I ever was in. Now, wherever did you pick up those prints? Make the place look so home-like. They do. Tell us. No wonder you're so fond of it. Tell us all about it. So Rat begins to make some supper for the two of them. At last, the rat had succeeded in decoying him to the table and had just got seriously to work with the sardine opener when sounds were heard from the forecourt without, sounds like the scuffling of small feet in the gravel and a confused murmur of tiny voices while broken sentences reached them. Now, all in a line, hold the lantern up a bit, Tommy. Clear your throats first. No coughing after I say one, two, three. Where's young Bill? Come on, come on. What were we waiting? What's up? Inquired the rat, pausing in his labors. I think it must be the field mice, replied the mole, with a touch of pride in his manner. They go round carol singing regularly at this time of the year. They're quite an institution in these parts, and they never pass me over. They come to Mole End last of all, and I used to give them hot drinks and supper too sometimes when I could afford it. It will be like old times to hear them again. Let's have a look at them, cried the rat, jumping up and running to the door. It was a pretty sight and a seasonable one that met their eyes when they flung the door open. In the forecourt, lit by the dim rays of a horn lantern, some 8 or 10 little field mice stood in a semicircle, red worsted comforters round their throats, their forepaws thrust deep into their pockets, their feet jiggling for warmth. With bright, beady eyes, they glanced shyly at each other, sniggering a little, sniffling, and applying coat sleeves a great deal. As the door opened, one of the elder ones that carried the lantern was just saying, "Now then, one, two, three." And forthwith, their shrill little voices uprose on the air, singing one of the old-time carols that their forefathers composed in fields that were fallow and held by frost, or when snowbound in chimney corners, and handed down to be sung in the miry streets to lamplit windows at Yule time. I'll omit the carol in the interest of time. The voices ceased. The singers, bashful but smiling, exchanged sidelong glances, and silence succeeded, but for a moment only. Then from up above and far away, down the tunnel they had so lately traveled, was borne to their ears, in a faint musical hum, the sound of distant bells ringing a joyful and clangorous peal. "Very well sung, boys," cried the Rat heartily. "Now come along in, all of you, and warm yourselves by the fire and have something hot." "Yes, come along, field mice," cried the Mole eagerly. "This is quite like old times. Shut the door after you. Pull up that settle to the fire. Now you just wait a minute while we..." "Oh, Ratty," he cried in despair, plumping down on a seat with tears impending. "Whatever are we doing? We've nothing to give them." "You leave all that to me," said the masterful Rat. "Here, you with the lantern, come over here this way. I want to talk to you. Now tell me, are there any shops open at this hour of the night?" "Why, certainly, sir," replied the field mouse respectfully. "At this time of year, our shops keep open to all sorts of hours." "Then look here," said the Rat. "You go off at once, you and your lantern, and you get me." Here much muttered conversation ensued, and the Mole heard only bits of it, such as, "Fresh, mine. No, pound of that will do. See you get Buggins. I won't have any. No, only the best. If you can't get it there, try somewhere else. Yes, homemade. Oh, no, no tin stuff. Well, then, do the best you can." Finally, there was a chink of coin passing from paw to paw. The field mouse was provided with an ample basket for his purchases, and off he hurried, he and his lantern. The rest of the field mice, perched in a row on the settle, their small legs swinging, gave themselves up to the enjoyment of the fire and toasted their chilblains till they tingled, while the Mole, failing to draw them into easy conversation, plunged into family history and made each of them recite the names of his numerous brothers, who were too young, it appeared, to be allowed to go out caroling this year, but looked forward very shortly to winning the parental consent. The Rat, meanwhile, was busy examining the label on one of the beer bottles. "I perceive this to be Old Burton," he remarked approvingly. "Sensible Mole, the very thing. Now we will be able to mull some ale. Get the things ready, Mole, while I draw the corks." Did not take long to prepare the brew and thrust the tin heater well into the red heart of the fire, and soon every field mouse was sipping and coughing and choking, for a little mulled ale goes a long way, and wiping his eyes and laughing and forgetting he had ever been cold in all his life. "They act plays, too, these fellows," the Mole explained to the Rat. "Make them up all by themselves and act them out afterwards. Very well they did it. They gave us a capital one last year about a field mouse who was captured at sea by a Barbary corsair and made to row in a galley, and when he escaped and got home again, his lady love had gone into a convent. Here, you were in it, I remember. Get up and recite a bit." The field mouse addressed got up on his legs, giggled shyly, looked around the room, and remained absolutely tongue-tied. His comrades cheered him on, Mole coaxed and encouraged him, and the Rat went so far as to take him by the shoulders and shake him, but nothing could overcome his stage fright. They were all busily engaged on him like watermen applying the Royal Humane Society's regulations to a case of long submersion, when the latch clicked, the door opened, and the field mouse with the lantern reappeared, staggering under the weight of his basket. There was no more talk of play-acting once the very real and solid contents of the basket had been tumbled out on the table. Under the generalship of Rat, everybody was set to do something or fetch something. In a very few minutes, supper was ready, and Mole, as he took the head of the table in a sort of dream, saw a lately barren board set thick with savory comforts, saw his little friends' faces brighten and beam as they fell to without delay, and then let himself loose, for he was famished indeed, on the provender so magically provided, thinking what a happy homecoming this had turned out after all. As they ate, they talked of old times, and the field mice gave him the local gossip up to date and answered as well as they could the 100 questions he had to ask them. The Rat said little or nothing, only taking care that each guest had what he wanted, and plenty of it, and that Mole had no trouble or anxiety about anything. Shortly after that, they all go off to bed, which is very nice after their strenuous day. Now, it seemed to me that as we hear that passage go by, we all must have heard things about feasting. What does it take for a feast? And how does Graham, without meaning, I think, to give a definition of feast, nonetheless do a kind of definitive feast in this scene? So this is your time to say what you heard as that was going by your ears. And of course, it's not as easy to do that as with a text in front of you, but
it seems to me that in order to have a feast, you have to have a group, you know, some folk who are hungry and who are looking forward to good things. And then I noticed in the passage that they all helped get it together. With much busyness, you know, and much conversation.
Bustling.
About, yes, bustling about. And I think maybe those are a couple of things that you need for a feast.
Mm-hmm. Good. And in the back?
Seeing the possibilities in what is at hand, no matter mm-hmm. how simple or elaborate it might be, okay. and sharing in conviviality as you prepare it.
Mm-hmm. And the, yes.
Preparing and sharing food, not just so everyone can sustain themselves, but because someone loves someone and they want to give something to them.
Right. There's so much sense of the warmth of exchange among those characters for the desire to please others. Certainly in this little instance, Mole, who wants to please others, is sort of abashed and incapable, and it takes the rat to sort of whoops him up to keep encouraging. And I always think that's interesting, that the one character who is the host officially has to be in a way shoved into the role and encouraged and chivied along and pulled and held up until he finally, in that almost the next to the last paragraph I read, he takes his place at the head of the table. Which for the food, which Graham even says seems magically provided.
Something else that drove them together, but I don't know if it was absolutely necessary, was the shared memories or our history.
They had done that before.
Yes, and I think we'll see that over and over again. And in the as we finish with Adam Bede this evening, that's probably the dominant characteristic of that passage in George Eliot's novel, Adam Bede, that the feast definitively includes the telling of tradition and history. Not only that there has been feasting before and that you tell about that to remember when we did this, but the telling of the history of the group becomes a part of what's done, becomes part of what makes it a feast. Great, you're doing wonderfully for people who just heard something go past your ears quickly.
And is part of it also entertainment, being entertained by recitations or plays or carols?
Yes, notice that there's music and recitation, or at least there's the promise of recitation, and the remembrance of past ones. Remember when they did such and such. And that little tiny detail of the story that is the plot of the drama that the mice had acted out the year before is an ancient story. At least in the Western tradition, back through medieval times. It's part of the patient Griselda story, I believe. So that's, you know, way back in the misty reaches of a Western tradition. And it's kind of cute that he has that as a mouse version of that is included as part of the tying of that community together. They not only have their own history, they share a tradition of histories, of stories. And those are part of the feast.
One thing I see too is that originally, Mole is stymied by his past. He wants what was there, and it takes Rat, who says, forget that, you know, let's look around and see. He encourages, and then, of course, as remembrance comes out and so forth. But originally, sometimes that the way it used to be,
right.
You want to do it that way again, is not
right. Good. Or it seems like the past is unrecoverable until there's some improvisation to move past that moment of stop in the present.
You mentioned Watt, the rat's resourcefulness a couple of times, but it also, he had money.
Yep. I was going to say. He had money and he's willing to expend it.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it takes resources. And that's a necessary part of feasting.
Except he saw a feast before it became a larger feast. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said, yes, we don't have champagne and blah, 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 but you have what is down in that cellar. I mean, you have possibilities. Someone else said that.
Mm-hmm. He was determined.
Yeah.
What?
He was determined to have it.
Yeah.
He wanted to have it, I think, and to bring Mole back into the mm-hmm. feast. I mean, he could have done it all himself. Rat could have, but I think he drew Mole in.
That beer that he discovered, was that sort of a cheap everyday brand, and then he thought about it for
so
the latest
right,
for
yes.
France.
Yes, and he makes a great deal out of what's there. You know, it becomes something other than dusty bottles of beer from the cellar. As he brings it out and talks about it, he makes it into something else by his offering of it to the person to whom it belongs. I mean, this is the wonderful sense of Mole being unable to conceive of this, and Ratty making it happen. And there does have to be agency, which in the sense of stores being open late at night, it's maybe the most magical thing. If you have ever tried to make a feast when the stores are shut, you can sympathize with this effort at a feast and wish that... that all stores were so available. But that is part of the kind of almost magical quality that this had. It's unexpected in a way.
But the feast was beginning before, I mean, well, I said possibility. Mole looked around with what was at hand and begun to make, or not Mole, Rat, mm-hmm. Make the feast. He wouldn't have had to have all the other things to make the feast.
You know how lonely it is to eat alone, you know? I mean, you can have the best food, but if you're eating by yourself, that's really not the best. But you can be eating a can of sardines and have a friend and some soda crackers and some good conversation and, you know.
And be closer to a feast.
You know? That's a nice snack or whatever. Feasting.
But does feasts necessarily have to require abundance and variety?
Right.
It's a state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the things that we will want to be exploring. I mean, whether, yes, state of mind, certainly, because I think in literary texts give us examples of sort of anti-feasts, that is, where all the materials of feast are present, and yet the result or the real definition of feast does not happen. Sort of the biblical story that springs to mind when you say the word feast, Belshazzar's feast. There is the occasion where all those pieces of abundance and of the gathering and the hospitality and there are many pieces of feast there. Yet the narrative as a whole functions as a kind of anti-feast story. It doesn't bring the expected rewards, benefits, possibilities of feast. But I think that probably it's necessary, or it might be necessary, that we will try to discover whether there are differences between feast and simply a good time with a meal.
Yeah.
And whether, in fact, feast is a different category of meal than even those very supercharged good times with food and other people. And that all the how many characteristics does it have to have before it qualifies as feast is something that I think should occupy us, and that I would hope that these texts shed light on in some ways to help us to understand better what we mean about the possibilities of a feast and why we use that then as such a powerful, central, more than metaphor in our religious life and experience. Any more things from Wind in the Willows? And that won't be the end of Wind in the Willows. We'll come back to it. And also the wonderful... tomorrow's subject is intimacy, which I identified as one of the needs, which in an odd way, maybe feasting also satisfies. And I said that to somebody that I was talking with about this session and back at home, and he immediately said, "Oh, it's too bad you can't show the scene from Tom Jones." Which anyone who has seen the scene from Tom Jones about eating and intimacy sort of immediately thinks of that was a little difficult. But there is a scene early in Wind in the Willows that I would identify as very illustrative also of intimacy and feasting. But before we finish this evening, I want to look at another scene. And this one, some of you will have in front of you in the handout, or you can share with others to look at. As I said, I was I got all these strenuous instructions about not using up paper by having handouts, and so I made only very few copies of this, thinking that anyone who is interested could... The selections are short enough that I think if you're interested in them, you can read them on your own and share them around, bring them back to other people. The ones that I want to look at tonight is from Adam Bede, and that's number 5 in this group of handouts, and it begins on page 9. There are these great big letters somewhere on the corner of the page. My daughter was very proud of those because she did this for me, and she made the computer do all these special numbers and put them on the pages. Anybody here read Adam Bede or read it lately? This is one of my favorite pieces of English literature, and very seldom read, and as it is such a thick and small print book, I think it's really, no one will ever read it again in another generation except doctoral students in English, which is such a pity. It's a wonderful book. It's central 5 chapters, which are quite a significant portion of the book, is given over to these chapters about the young heir's coming of age festival. George Eliot is writing at a time, this book is written in the mid-50s, I believe, 1856, something like that. She's writing about a time at least 50 years earlier, and about the traditions and festivals of rural England. And one of the major ones, but not fixed to any church calendar or date, was the coming-of-age party for the heir of any large estate. And in the novel Adam Bede, the coming-of-age of the young squire, Arthur Donnithorne, is a central moment in the novel's plot and the revelation of many characters and relationships that are at a kind of critical moment at this point. But I'm not going to focus here our attention on what is happening to or in the lives of the major characters, but instead on what Eliot is interested in about the event and its meaning for community, because that's principally how the event is set into a context. What makes this moment important is not its importance for Arthur Donnithorne, who is the young man who happens to be 21 at this moment. I mean, in a way, he's almost irrelevant. The point of the thing is the moment in the community's history. And I think she begins to make that point. This chapter 22 is the first of five chapters she devotes to this episode in the plot. And if we look at it here, we can see how she sets that up. The 30th of July was come. It was one of those half dozen warm days which sometimes occur in the middle of a rainy English summer. This is a special time just from the point of view of climate. She talks about it as perfect weather for outdoor July merrymaking. Down a little farther, it is the time of leisure on the farm, that pause between hay and corn harvest, and so the farmers and laborers in Hayslope and Broxton thought the captain did well to come of age just then, when they could give their undivided minds to the flavor of the great cask of ale which had been brewed the autumn after the heir was born and was to be tapped on his 21st birthday. The whole section concentrates on memory. And right here on the first page, and I hope this is not, maybe it's just the Lutheran in me that responds to these occasions where ale is of the essence, but also something is important here. Ale is a very visible symbol of time. And this cask of ale, brewed as the baby is born, and set down so that when he comes of age, it can be tapped and given out to the community. This is not just the fine Madeira that is put down in the cellar for him to inherit. It's what is going to be used for the feast on his 21st birthday for everyone. And the laborers here think that great time, July, because now as they begin to get the cask ready to tap, to pour out in all its abundance, they don't have the heavy tasks of the farm right now. They're freed of those for a while. That is sort of the first page. When we go on to the next, these are selections and only. This next section of the text concerns the sort of head farm family, not the squire's family, but the main family of tenants, the prime tenant farmer, Martin Poyser and his family, and it is to that family that Adam himself is attached. I think this two pages on page 10 have some nice things about the life of this family and the way it fits into the life of the whole. But I would call your attention to that second column on page 10. As the Poyser family gets in their wagon and goes to the main house grounds for the big party. And they're all in the wagon. Mr. Poyser and his father are in the wagon. Poyser is a man of 50-some. And he and his wife are the very picture of the prosperous farmer and their household. His father, a very elderly man, and then their children and their servants from the household. Mr. Poyser drove at no more than a walking pace that there might be as little risk of jolting as possible on this warm day, and there was time to exchange greetings and remarks with the foot passengers who were going the same way, specking the paths between the green meadows and the golden cornfields with bits of movable bright color, a scarlet waistcoat to match the poppies that nodded a little too thickly among the corn, or a dark blue neckerchief with ends flaunting across a brand new white smock frock. You can identify, if you know English, English rural life, exactly where this is. It's the English sort of low Midlands, southern Midlands, and Warwickshire, where Eliot herself was born and raised. By that identification of the stockman's smock, which is a... She's very concerned always to locate and ground the story in the realities of the countryside and the community that form it. All Broxton and all Hayslope were to be at the Chase, that's the estate, the center of the estate, and make merry there in honor of the heir. And the old men and women, who had never been so far down this side of the hill for the last 20 years, were being brought from Broxton and Hayslope in one of the farmer's wagons at Mr. Irwin's suggestion. That's an interesting thing in itself. Irwin is the clergyman of the area. He is the rector of the church, and thus he is also the squire's employee in some sense. He runs the church at the squire's organization. And it's his suggestion that all the old people, the people who are perhaps too old and frail to be moved by their own families and whatever the conveyance they either have or don't have, but that someone should provide that the community bring these old people to the festivities, even the ones whose own families can't bring them. And it is the church that urges and makes this suggestion. That's a neat little detail. The church bells had struck up again now, a last tune before the ringers came down the hill to have their share of the festival. And that's another little note about how making a feast and making a festival always takes the labor of some people who can't do the festival because they're preparing it for others. Even the bell ringers, in order for the festivity to be taking place, the bell ringers are the last ones to get there. We hope that the cask will not be dried out before they get down the hill. And before the bells had finished, other music was heard approaching, so that even old Brown, the sober horse that was drawing Mr. Poyser's cart, began to prick up his ears. It was the band of the Benefit Club, which had mustered in all its glory, that is to say, in bright blue scarves and blue favors, carrying its banner with the motto, "Let brotherly love continue," encircling a picture of a stone pit. So, from the occupation of those who are not on the farms. Mm-hmm. The carts, of course, were not to enter the chase. Everyone must get down at the lodges, that is the houses that sit at the end of the drive, which the formal drive that comes up to the house itself, to the big house, and the vehicles sent back. "Why, the chase is like a fair already," said Mrs. Poyser as she got down from the cart and saw the group scattered under the great oaks and the boys running about in the hot sunshine to survey the tall poles surmounted by the fluttering garments that were to be the prize of the successful climbers. This was rural sports. You put up tall poles with a nice coat or a jacket or hat at the top, and those who were strongest and fastest at the signal could get them. I should have thought there was not so many people in two parishes. Mercy on us, how hot it is out of the shade. Come here, Toddy, else your little face will be burnt to a scratching. They might have cooked the dinners in that open space and saved the fires. I shall go to Mrs. Bestroom and sit down. Stop a bit. This is the part that I want to call our attention to, particularly before we close here. Stop a bit, said Mr. Poyser. "There's the wagon coming with the old folks in it. It'll be such a sight as when I come o'er again to see 'em get down and walk along all together. You remember some of 'em in their prime, eh, Father?" Aye, said old Martin, walking slowly under the shade of the lodge porch, from which he could see the aged party descend. "I remember Jacob Taff walking 50 mile after the Scotch Rabels when they turned back from Stoniton. He felt himself quite a youngster with a long life before him as he saw the Hayslope patriarch, old Father Taff, descend from the wagon and walk towards him in his brown nightcap and leaning on his two sticks. "Well, Mr. Taft," shouted old Martin at the utmost stretch of his voice, for though he knew the old man was stone deaf, he could not omit the propriety of a grin. "You're hearty yet. You can enjoy yourself today for all your 90 and better." "Your servant, masters, your servant," said Father Taft in a treble tone, perceiving that he was in company. The aged group, under care of sons and daughters, themselves worn and gray, passed on along the least winding carriage road towards the house, where a special table was prepared for them, while the Poyser party wisely struck out across the grass under the shade of the great trees. Oh, and then she goes on with some architectural detail. But I would want to point out about this passage, which I think is just so immensely rich that you could practically write a doctoral dissertation on it. What Eliot has put in front of us here is the whole nature of community and the way community works is both to operate within time but also to obliterate time. So that each thing that is mentioned in this passage is about how old these old people are. But notice that the grandfather of the family on whom our attention is sees himself as a young man when he looks at the older man. Mm-hmm. And it is the remembrance of that older man coming as a young man, coming back from a piece of history, piece of formal national history in the defeat of the Scotch rebels, which is a long time before. And yet in this moment, the grandfather sees himself as his younger self looking at a prior generation. And there is this kind of collapse of the generations into this one moment. And it's the father, notice it's Mr. Poyser who has said, "Stop, stop," you know, to his own family. "Don't get down right away and walk away and miss this. Stop. See this. Pay attention." And the whole festival functions that way for the community, that it stops and notices and pays attention to this continuity of experience and time amongst them. The scene goes on for a bit, and very shortly they all sit down to, that not everyone, the upper level of the tenantry, as it's called, sits down, and they are to have their toasts to the health of the young squire. But before we get to that scene, and I, those of you who want to take this and read it will certainly enjoy it, I think even without knowing the rest of the story. I'm trying to find the piece of it that I hope is here. When, as the tenantry has their banquet, the young squire, who is being coached by the rector of the church, by Mr. Irwin, in how to do this, they talk about the what's going to happen. And the young squire talks about what he wants to happen at this event is that everyone who is there at this moment will remember someday when they are older and tell their own grandchildren that they were there at the young squire's coming of age party. And that it, so that there is not only in this scene the sense of the past, the grandfather and his memory of the older man, but that the young squire says he didn't want to have a specialized party just for the grown-ups or for one little stratum of age groups, you know, not just for the Mr. Poysers, but he wants all the children there so that when they are grown up, they can tell their children and their grandchildren that they were there on the day when the old squire was just coming of age. And that whole scene is so crucial for Eliot in making a determination about the nature of community, what it means. It is this great event, but it is a great event that happens in the particular context of this spectrum of time and persons, and the recognition of each of the kind of the segments, the age segments or age cohorts, we would call them today. Other things that you notice with the text in front of you. This doesn't tell anything about the feast itself, the great ox that is being roasted. The only piece of this that I have given you is probably that great cask of ale, which was laid down 21 years before. Are there any similarities between this and the Wind in the Willows passage? Yes, and it's interesting that Graham says that he does that because there was no easy conversation available.
Right. And
that is a part of what we know as a kind. It is artificial to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And who is your cousin? I don't remember. You know, was that those people, or was that the other side of the family? We go through those as a very. It is artificial conversation. It seems in a way not authentic, and yet it's deeply human as a part of the gathering, particularly the intergenerational conversation and gathering. And that happens here, I think, when it's the father who tells the rest of the family, no, stop, wait, you know, don't do the sensible thing and go in the shade right away. You know, this is a moment that we must stop and observe, even if it's difficult or seems foolish to do that. It must happen.
Same thing when he greets the old man who he knows is stone deaf.
Yes,
that's
good point.
Artificial.
Right. Yes, it's very artificial to make that gesture of kind of obeisance before the elder, and especially when the elder can't even hear. But that the exchange takes place is important, and the elder notices. I mean, he sees he's in the presence of other people, and he assumes they're talking to him, so he says something back. It may even be a non sequitur, but both of them understand that there is a meaning in the exchange, which the words themselves don't fully identify. Oh, here is the one that I meant. It is on this page. When I was looking for it, I couldn't find it. It's on page 12 in the first column. As chapter 24 begins, and chapter 24 is called The Health Drinking, the young squire and the rector are walking through the house, and they're walking through, this is the grand estate house, so the moldy portraits of Queen Elizabeth and her ladies and all these sort of old family pictures are there. As they walk through the old piece of the house, Arthur is the young squire, and he says to the rector, if I am ever master here, I shall do up the gallery in a first-rate style. We've got no room in the house a third as large as this. That second table is for the farmers' wives and children. He's identifying the way they've laid out this feast and the way that he's organized how everyone will be seated and fed. That second table is for the farmers' wives and children. Mrs. Best said it would be more comfortable for the mothers and children to be by themselves. I was determined to have the children and make a regular family thing of it. I shall be the old squire to those little lads and lasses someday, and they'll tell their children what a much finer young fellow I was than my own son. There's a table for the women and children below as well, but you will see them all. You'll come up with me after dinner, I hope. Yes, to be sure, said Mr. Irwin, I wouldn't miss your maiden speech to the tenantry. That's sort of a joke in there, since the typical maiden speech, or the way that usually refers to the Lord's first speech in Parliament, which would be his first entry into great public life. Mm-hmm. Here the rector kind of has this little joke when he says to him, your maiden speech to the tenantry. But this signifies, and certainly this is true for Eliot, the great history of human life happens in these moments, not in the speech that Arthur would make to Parliament, which in fact, because of the tragedy that happens, he never makes. And he does not have those little children to identify him as the old squire in some later time. Because of sinfulness, which interrupts this idol, that there is a break in the continuity that is expected, and that's the material that Eliot is working with. The focus of the plot is that the nature of that tragedy. And for her, the nature of the tragedy is not so much the personal one that happens for Arthur and for Hetty and for Adam, but that's too bad, or it's sad, or it's unhappy in their own lives. But it is the break to the continuity of this community, which endures a terrible breach because of the way those individuals act, and cause a rupture in the history that she has so beautifully laid out in these five chapters, when she identifies this kind of layered piece of the community with its earlier years and later years all seen together. I recommend this book very highly, although it is long and takes a lot of patience. Well, we're nearly out of time for tonight, and as I said, tomorrow's session I want to focus on, or we'll do some more thinking about the quality of intimacy, but I don't think that any one of these sessions will sort of be able to shut out every other part of the discussion, so that I assume that some community stuff will spill over into tomorrow, and any of these other what I have identified as needs or hungers that feasting means could certainly be brought into the conversation at any point. And certainly I'm terribly interested in any other titles that you think of that you think fit under that category, or in any other category, feasting titles. Tonight, those of you who are able will be showing Babette's Feast again. We'll be showing Babette's Feast. I gather this is the fourth time it's been shown this summer in the village. So, even those of us who have seen it three or four times may enjoy the possibility of seeing it again and enjoying it again.
What time? 8:30 here in this room, is that right?
8:30 here, yeah.
8:30.
Other things?
If there are people that cannot watch the film and want to use the tape that I have, if they can...
Oh, that's right. Gloria Keller has, they've brought along for their trip a beautiful cassette of the reading of the book by Colleen Dewhurst. So those of you who have tape recorders there's certainly lots of access to tape around here.
It takes about an hour and a half.
But I would recommend also... I would recommend also that you go to the bookstore and buy the book and read the real thing, as it is a beautifully, beautifully told story in its original, I believe, written in English by a native-speaking Dane. There's a lot of the same kind of care about language that Joseph Conrad is an adult learner of English uses for his language. The same is true with Isaac Dinesen, who writes beautifully in English. So I certainly recommend reading the story, and the book is not very heavy to carry back home. Thank you very much.
I have